Welcome back to the Burrowshire podcast. I'm Brandon Vaught. I'm one of the co-hosts. The other co-host is here with me, my best friend, Father Blake Britton. Father Blake, good to see you.
Thank you. Wonderful to see you as well, especially for this current episode.
We've been wanting to do an episode for a long time on G.K. Chesterton and another episode on Pope Benedict XVI, both of whom are our favorite writers. And we eventually just said, well, let's just do one episode with both of them. So I'm not quite sure if that was a prudent idea. We'll see if this ends up being a 3 or 4 hour episode. But that's the title of today's episode, Chesterton and Pope Benedict XVI. We did think, though, after reflecting on this combination more, what is it that unites these two men together? Maybe I'll let you start off with that analysis, because both of these are giant spiritual masters of the 20th century, and for Benedict, the early 21st century. But what connects these two men together in your mind?
Yeah, I was right there with you. Initially, I laughed a little bit when I saw the heading for this particular episode, because I thought, well, there's the benefits of having our own podcast. You know, we just took two of our favorite things and put them together. Sort of like how we named our podcast as well, the Burrowshire podcast. We just took the two things that we loved and put them into the same place. But as I prayed more about it, I realized that these two pivotal players in church history most certainly have a lot of correlations. I know that you came up with your own understandings of how they're related, but in my own heart, as I prayed with it, I realized that both of these men had such a genius in their ability to identify and speak to their age. Chesterton, of course, was able to keep his finger on the pulse, specifically in the rise of militant atheism and agnosticism, and to address these different movements philosophically, both continental and transcontinental, that are taking place in the world, and speak to them with such pithiness, such wit, and really go straight to the core of things. And that's why, of course, he's dubbed the great apostle of common sense, which we'll speak about more in the episode later on. And with Benedict XVI, the same gift. He, more than anyone, in my opinion, has this ability to just see through all of the confusion and all the blurred lines of modernity and postmodernity, so as to arrive at the real heart of questions, at the real core of being, and is able to also explain that core with such clarity.
Yeah, for me, that last word is really the connecting thread, clarity. It's interesting, both men have very different styles. Chesterton's writing style is rollicking and whimsical, and, you know, Bishop Barron says it's like opening a bottle of champagne. There's just, you know, fizz spewing all over the place. And Ratzinger Benedict, he's more disciplined and linear and straightforward, although he has a poetic, you know, lyrical style as well. But what connects both of them is this remarkable clarity. Despite their differing styles, they both saw the world clearly, they both saw God clearly, they both saw the church, theology clearly. And I think that's what still attracts a lot of people to both of their writings. You also mentioned that they were sort of the right men at the right time to answer the challenges of their age. And it reminds me of this Chesterton quote. It's probably not going to be the last time I say that this episode. Chesterton said, sometimes the age is converted by the saint who contradicts it most. Sometimes the age is contradicted converted by the saint who contradicts it most. And I think both Chesterton and Benedict fit that description. In many ways, they're dinosaurs of an older age. You know, they don't quite fit in with the postmodern relativistic world, you know, a more liberal turn in the theological landscape. But both of them converted much of that age because they contradicted it in many ways.
And right. Their contradiction is what really lies at the heart of what speaks to the world the most, because in that contradiction, the world actually realizes, wait, these men have found the truth that my heart's longing for. And that's why they become so attractive. So we have, in both their age, both their time periods, the world going a certain direction, meaning society going in a particular philosophical, theological direction. And these two men tap into the depths of tradition and the wisdom of the past in a very new and relevant way, so that it awakens within the hearts of the masses this understanding that, wait a second, we actually don't want to go with this newfound ideology. What we are aching for are these timeless truths that these men are talking about.
another connection that you and I had both noted when discussing these two figures is their remarkable innocence. And by another synonym would be purity, the remarkable childlikeness. We see this with Benedict. I think it was a few episodes back we shared that story where someone asked him, had he ever seen a rated R movie? And he said, you know, are kids allowed to watch rated R movies? And they said no. And then he said, well, why would I? And, you right. know, I think that is very telling for Benedict. But then Chesterton displayed many of the same things. Is despite his profound understanding of evil and suffering and pain, he nevertheless bore this extraordinary childlike innocence. They hadn't been tainted by the dirt and the muck of the world. They're almost a sort of ethereal figure, like many saints are, that land in our world, but seem like they're so pure, they're so innocent that they're born from another world. So I think both of these figures have that in common.
Most certainly. Some would say that they're inhumane, meaning that they're almost not human because they're so perfect or they're so holy. But that the complete opposite is actually true. The fact of the matter is that men like these and women like these, we look at Teresa of Calcutta, Teresa of Avila, Catherine of Siena, these men and women are actually the most human among us. We're the ones who are being inhumane. We're the ones that are subscribing ourselves to ideologies, to mindsets, to spiritualities that are not really correlating to the fullness of our human nature. But when you look at someone like Benedict or Chesterton, you see, wow, this is someone who fulfills John chapter 10, verse 10. I candy might have life and have it to the fullest, Jesus Christ says. These two men lived their life to the fullest. They have a humanity that is so real that it actually awakens the lack of humanity in each of us.
All right. So I think what I'd like to do is let's spend a good deal of time first on Chesterton, and then we'll move to Benedict, and we'll kind of split the episode in half that way. And, you know, both of these writers I mentioned are top five writers for each one of us, although Chesterton is my number one guy, and Benedict, I know, is your number one guy. So given that, I think maybe I'll go ahead and do like a bio and a brief background of Chesterton. We'll talk about him a little bit, and then you can introduce us to Pope Benedict XVI.
Gladly. So, we should save the best for last.
We're just going chronologically, not necessarily in order of priority or importance. Okay, so G.K. Chesterton, we've talked about him a lot on this podcast. And if you've been listening to me, if you've been listening to Burrowshire, if you've been listening to Word on Fire, you probably have a cursory background on who he is. But real briefly, Chesterton was one of the most prophetic and prolific writers of the 20th century. And I mean that if you survey every writer, novelist, author, journalist of the 20th century, Chesterton is either at the top or at the very near top in terms of his output. He wrote thousands and thousands of essays. He wrote daily and weekly essays for over 30 years. He wrote over 100 books, and they span almost every genre. He wrote poetry, plays, novels, detective stories, political essays, theology, philosophy, you name it. He wrote on nearly every single topic under the sun. He's also maybe the most quoted author of the 20th century. I've seen many secular sources describe him that way. They say his only competition maybe was Winston Churchill, but besides Churchill, Chesterton just has a gift for the pithiness turn of a phrase so that, I mean, there's 100 quotes we could cite here that have made their way into the popular imagination. He's best known for his witty and whimsical style, the style of his prose, but again, as we mentioned at the beginning, also the remarkable clarity of his ideas. When he writes on topics like the economy or education or threats against the family, even though he's writing about those things in the early 20th century, they read as incredibly relevant today. It could be out of, you know, yesterday's newspaper. So he's got this perennial relevance and clarity among his writings. Brief biography. So he was born in 1874 in England, which is where he lived all of his life. He was a very big man. He was 6'4", over 300 pounds. He often wore a cape and a top hat and carried a sword stick. I have a good friend who also happens to be on this podcast who also has a sword stick. So Chesterton.
Every true gentleman should have a sword stick, Brandon.
So Chesterton was, you know, a larger than life figure. He was a mega celebrity in his day, especially on Fleet Street, which was one of the buzzing parts of London, where a lot of the pubs and a lot of the journalists would hang out. Chesterton, he had a sort of a mixed educational background growing up. He wasn't a strong student. He, after graduating what we would call high school, he went to the Slade School of Art. So he was training to become an artist, while most of his friends went to either Oxford or Cambridge. But he went to an art school and ended up dropping out before graduating. So he never even got a college degree. But almost immediately after leaving, he became a book reviewer and had great success there. His reviews were widely applauded, and then became a journalist, which was the profession that he had for the rest of his life. He sort of grew up in a nominally Christian home, and then fell away, became agnostic, and even dabbled a little bit in things like the Ouija board and demonic, spirituality while he was a young man. But then slowly he came back to the Christian faith and became a great defender of Christianity, despite it falling out of favor among most other English citizens. He wrote his most famous book, titled Orthodoxy, which we'll talk about here in a moment, in 1908. And that book was essentially a defense of traditional Christian theology, although it also defended Catholic theology. And in fact, many people thought that by writing this book, Chesterton had converted to Catholicism, despite being an Anglican, and had even wrote him letters congratulating him for joining the Catholic Church. But he didn't convert to Catholicism until 1922, 14 years after writing Orthodoxy. And then his wife converted shortly thereafter to Catholicism as well. And then Chesterton died in 1936. He, again, left a lasting legacy on the English landscape of language, of history, theology, poetry, the literary world. He also has affected a lot of the latter part of the 20th century by serving as a convert maker. So probably the most famous example is C.S. Lewis. C.S. Lewis attributes his conversion to Christianity in large part because of Chesterton. Lewis wrote this in his autobiography: "In reading Chesterton, I did not know what I was letting myself in for. A young man who wishes to remain a sound atheist cannot be too careful of his reading." And he's describing there picking up Chesterton's book titled The Everlasting Man. He says, "I'd never heard of him and had no idea of what he stood for, nor can I quite understand why he made such an immediate conquest of me. It might have been expected that my pessimism, my atheism, and my hatred of sentiment would have made him to me the least congenial of all authors. It would almost seem that Providence, or some secondary cause of a very obscure kind, quite overrules our previous tastes when it decides to bring minds together. Liking an author may be as involuntary and improbable as falling in love." So Lewis fell in love with Chesterton. Chesterton helped him see that Christianity was true. And then look at the staggering influence C.S. Lewis has had over the last 100 years. And you can trace that back to the fountainhead of G.K. Chesterton. That's a brief introduction to who Chesterton is. Maybe let's talk about some of his major contributions. And I'll let you pick up the tale there, Blake.
Yeah, so some of his great works, I know you and I both have particular favorites that we love about him. We, as you already mentioned, Chesterton did a phenomenal job speaking to his age, especially in his debates. I think of those famous debates that he had with Bernard Shaw. One of my favorite interactions between the two of them was in the middle of a debate when Chesterton, who was very jovial and had a very Catholic spirit, to Bernard Shaw, "Well, Mr. Shaw, if everyone looked at you, they would think that England was in famine." And Shaw very wittily responded back, "Yes, Mr. Chesterton, if they looked at you, they think that you caused it." And even that speaks to a great gift that Chesterton had in recognizing that even when there's someone with whom you may have animosity intellectually, that doesn't mean that outside of the debate, outside of the philosophical contradiction, you can't have a true and lasting friendship. So his ability to recognize the goodness in others. But yes, his contributions as far as debating, as far as speaking to the times of his age, the spirit of his age, getting down to specific works. In my own life, I first encountered Chesterton as a 14-year-old man. And I remember going into Barnes & Noble. I had just sort of had a reversion, if you will, or a reawakening of my vocation, especially to the priesthood. And so my heart was aching to better understand philosophy, theology. So my mom and dad took me to Barnes & Noble. I went to the Catholic section, which was a very pathetic section at Barnes & Noble, now that I look back on it with a little bit more expertise. But in that section, there were three books that I bought. I bought The Catechism of the Catholic Church, Teresa of Avila's Interior Castle, and G.K. Chesterton's Orthodoxy. I never read any of those three things. And I went home and I read them cover to cover over the next several weeks. At that moment, Chesterton became one of my favorite authors. His stirring gift, his stirring and keen intellect, when he would speak, it would speak to truths inside my own soul, even at 14. And of course, I loved his turn of phrase. I was traditionally trained as an artist. You know, I was an opera singer, and already at that point I was singing with the Orlando Opera. And I also enjoyed just good poetry, good prose, his ability to strike up amazing phrases and draw wonderful analogies and metaphors to tell stories. And so those things drew me to Chesterton right away. And I immediately fell in love with him, as C.S. Lewis did. And I started reading him, and he continues to be someone who I turn to on a regular basis. I just read him a couple nights ago before bed because I wanted to do a study on his interpretation of the American economy and American political system at the turn of the century. And as I was reading, I was in shock to see, once again, that prophetic voice that you had mentioned at the beginning, Brandon, his ability just to speak and to really prophesy about these ideologies in the United States and where they're leading us even to this day was really shocking to me. So Chesterton still continues to inspire me as far as his intellect and his journalism. Then you introduced me, actually, to what is now my second favorite Chesterton work, The Ballad of the White Horse. When I spoke with Dale Alquist about this, and he's one of the foremost Chesterton scholars in the world, he said this is one of Chesterton's most accomplished works and yet one of his most unappreciated works. And it's really an epic poem. So we know that we have Beowulf, Dante's Inferno, his Paradiso, his Purgatorio. And so epic poetry is a whole field of literature, which really no one's contributed to in recent history. But as I look at Chesterton's Ballad of the White Horse, I would say with all boldness that this really is an epic poem that deserves to be numbered among all of those others. It's quite a feat of the English language. The prose and poetry is phenomenal, and also its Christian anthropology and theology is nothing short of inspiring. So those are the two works and sort of the two great contributions that I see Chesterton's left us in his many, many hundreds and thousands of pages of literature. I actually require my eighth graders in my class to read Ballad of the White Horse. And it's one of the things that they have to study and sort of see where the Christian analogies and metaphors are, and also to recite certain passages of it from memory. So last year when I was teaching the eighth grade, I had some of them do that. But those are the two ones that I really, really continue to turn to on a regular basis. So what about for you, Brandon? And you only get to choose like two or three, okay?
It's an impossible task. It's like asking about your favorite children. No, instead of talking about my favorite books, I think I'll continue the thread of what are the lasting lessons that I think Chesterton has given us in the church, given us his readers. And I jotted down a few that I think encapsulate how he's affected me. So first of all, what I would describe is the thrill of orthodoxy. And this is kind of the central premise of his book with that title, Orthodoxy, that orthodoxy, it's kind of unfortunate that he named the book that way, because many people, including myself, when I first found the book, I thought, this sounds so dull and boring, orthodoxy. Who wants to read a book titled Orthodoxy? But the point of the book is that orthodoxy is not dull and dusty and uninspiring, but that properly understood, it's fiery and vivacious and full of life. He describes the church as riding on this chariot with these galloping horses throughout history, veering left and right away from this heresy and that heresy, and sailing its way through the centuries to finally bring us to where we are today, using the creeds as sort of the signpost along the way to guide this roaring chariot. So I don't think anybody who's read that book, Orthodoxy, will close it thinking that orthodoxy is boring any longer. He makes you think that theology matters, theology is important, and theology is exciting. So for any budding theologian or anybody who's trying to get into theology or maybe apologetics, that book, I think, does the best job of showing this thrill of orthodoxy. Second, is Chesterton's ability to showcase the wonder of ordinary life. He had such a deep appreciation for things as they are, because they are. He loved a tree just because it was a tree and because of its treeness, that it glorified God by being just what it is, a tree. He loved the rain. He loved top hats. He loved ordinary domestic life, family life. You know, he reveled in food and drink. He just appreciated the common things of life with such glory and gratitude, unparalleled, I think, in any other writer in the 20th century. So the more you read him, the more you come to share in that thankfulness for all that God has created. It's kind of the flip side of much of the 20th century, which was drifting toward nihilism and pessimism, that was seeing everything covered by a dark shadow. He saw the light in everything. He was just bubbling with joy, bubbling with gratitude, and it's infectious when you read his writings. You mentioned this one, so I won't go too far into it, but his gift for friendship, especially with his intellectual opponents. You know, George Bernard Shaw, who you mentioned, was the opposite of Chesterton in every imaginable way. So Chesterton was this large, jolly, you know, heavy drinking Catholic. And George Bernard Shaw was this rail-thin Irishman. Chesterton was English, a teetotaler. He didn't drink at all, and he was a vegetarian, so he didn't, like, you know, eat meat and drink like Chesterton. So in terms of personality, they were completely different. In terms of ideas, they were radically different. Shaw was an atheist and a socialist. Chesterton, you know, was a Catholic and championing democracy and capitalism, and then eventually distributism, which we don't have time to get into here. But nevertheless, whoever he disagreed with, he was still friendly with them. There's stories that after him and Bernard Shaw would have, you know, an intense 2-hour debate, after that they'd go to the pub and they'd be clanking tankards together as they'd be drinking and laughing and telling jokes. Yeah. I think we desperately miss that today. You know, we just came out of this really intense, tumultuous, turbulent political period where it's so locked into binary antagonism, with people on one side hating people on the other side. Chesterton shows us, I think, how to bridge that gap, how to become friends and how to love people, even though you have strong disagreements. You don't have to give up the disagreements or paper over them, but you can still love them and have good relationships.
And certainly. I think that you and I both, witnessed that when we were in England. So Brandon and I had the privilege of going to see some of Chesterton's private items, you know, his top hat and his books, and it was just splendid.
His glasses.
But his glasses, which I got to sort of throw on, and which is really cool. But one of the most touching things of Chesterton's that I really was inspired by were his cartoons and his different theater pieces that he would paint and make. And it really showed, and by the way, he did this for children. He and his wife were not able to have children, unfortunately. And so he did this to really father, if you will, and create imagination in the children that lived with him in his town. And you could see there his wonder with reality. And I agree with you, Brandon. I think that's one of his greatest gifts, this unbelievable belief, this unbelievable conviction that this world is a splendid and amazing place, and it's worth loving and celebrating constantly. And you could see that in Chesterton and all the things that he does.
One final thing that I like about him is you mentioned that he and his wife, Frances, were infertile, and that was deeply disheartening to them because they wanted a huge family. They wanted lots of kids. Both of the Chestertons loved children. They always had children in their house, but they were infertile. Nevertheless, their marriage was such a witness to fecundity and fruitfulness. I think they might be the patrons, you know, they're not officially canonized, but the patrons of what infertile couples can still do. Infertility is such a difficult cross, you know, for those of us who know friends or family members struggling with it. Oftentimes it feels like it's just, you know, this burden that is just utterly devastating. If you're a married couple and you're unable to have kids, you think your marriage is somehow, you know, barren forever.
Right.
But the Chesterton show, that's just not the case. You know, there was so much life and love bubbling in their house that, again, I think they can serve as a great witness to marriage in general, but especially to infertile marriages in particular.
Most certainly. Most certainly.
Okay, let's close the Chesterton section reluctantly because I could talk for about 10 more hours on Chesterton. I thought maybe what we'd do is offer some practical recommendations on where people should start with Chesterton. So maybe you've heard a Chesterton quote here or there, maybe you've read one or two of his books and you want to get more into them. It's kind of a good news, bad news situation with Chesterton. The good news is he's written so much on so many things that there's like a million entry points, you know, whether you like poetry or plays or, you know, detective stories or essays, you know, there's a route into Chesterton from a million directions. But that's also the bad news is that it can be overwhelming because you just don't know where to start among his thousands of essays and hundreds of books. So let me offer a few of my recommendations and then Blake, I'll let you chime in too. So first of all, I think, and of course I'm a little biased here, but I think the best way to get into Chesterton is watch the 1 hour documentary that we produced at Word on Fire on Chesterton, which is a part of Bishop Barron's Pivotal Players film series. So I'll include a link to that in the show notes, but it's our Pivotal Players episode on G.K. Chesterton. It's about 1 hour long, and it's so beautifully filmed because it goes to all the sites associated with Chesterton, Bishop Barron standing in front of, you know, the pubs and the offices and the churches. He's talking about Chesterton the person. So like the first half is biographical, but then the second half goes into some of his key books, including Orthodoxy and The Everlasting Man. So that is the most beautiful visual introduction to Chesterton that I'm aware of. So I always recommend people start with that. In terms of books, it just totally depends on who the person is and what genre they're interested in. So for fiction, Chesterton wrote a handful of novels, all sorts of short stories, but I typically tell people to start with his Father Brown detective stories. So Father Brown was this little priest that Chesterton created based on a priest friend of his named Father John O'Connor. And he is still revered, I think, as the second most famous fictional detective, especially in England, right behind Sherlock Holmes. Father Brown had this gift for solving crimes based on the knowledge of human sinfulness and psychology that he gained through the confessional. So by hearing the confessions of thousands and thousands and thousands of people over the years, he came to learn how the twisted human mind works. And so he was able to solve crimes on that basis. So a delightful, witty set of mystery stories, and they're short. And you kind of get the Chesterton style and the Chesterton flair through those stories. That's a good place to start.
Yeah, and in those stories as well, if I could just comment on that, those are among some of my favorite Chesterton writings. Those stories do a great job also teaching deep moral lessons, especially about humanity. So I was struck, for example, in one of the stories in which the criminal is caught by Father Brown, and the person against whom the crime was committed, this criminal had stolen something from the person who asked Father Brown to help. That person was like, he should be executed, he should be killed, he should be punished. And Father Brown so beautifully says, "You live in a world with no mercy. You live in a world where you're only willing to forgive sins that you don't think are sins. But here is someone who's actually a sinner, and they're the ones that deserve the forgiveness of all." So also within these, they're very creative stories, but also within these essays, within these short stories, there's deep moral lessons. And that's what I love about Father Brown. There's also a great BBC show that's based on, loosely based on the Father Brown novels, but the character is original to G.K. Chesterton.
Good. Some other ones I'd recommend. If you like poetry, he wrote two grand poems. We mentioned the one, Ballad of the Epic Horse, which I think is arguably his best piece of writing, qua writing. It's long. It's, as Father Blake said, the last great epic poem in the English language. There really hasn't been one since. But he also has a much shorter one called Lepanto, which celebrates the great Battle of Lepanto, where a very small minority of Catholic forces were able to resist this massive onslaught of Muslim ships. And that's also where we get the Feast of Our Lady of the Rosary. It's commemorated each year in the church's liturgy. So Lepanto is a much shorter introduction to Chesterton's poetry. In terms of essays, there's a good collection called In Defense of Sanity, where Dale Alquist and Joseph Pierce and Father Aidan, or not Father, Aidan Mackie, three of the great Chesterton experts pick their favorite Chesterton essays of all time and put them into one book. Orthodoxy and Everlasting Man, if you're looking for theology or apologetics, those are widely considered by most people to be his two best books. They're a little challenging, can be a little intimidating for the first-time reader. So you might want to take a crack at them, and if they're not speaking to you, maybe try some of these other ones. And then finally, for a cultural route, check out his book, What's Wrong with the World. It's sort of a collection of essays touching on politics and culture and education and the family, a wide range of problems from the early 20th century that remain problems today. I also recommend any of Dale Alquist's books. We've mentioned his name. He's kind of the foremost defender and promoter of G.K. Chesterton today. He has a bunch of good introductory books on Chesterton. I'll link to them below. And then last but not least, the website chesterton.org. So that is a tremendous website full of easy to access information. They have a whole Chesterton University section where you can read different lectures on Chesterton's different books, all free. So check that out, chesterton.org. You want to say anything else about G.K. Chesterton before we turn to Pope Benedict?
I think we should turn to Pope Benedict.
you better cut me off here, but we're just hitting the 30-minute mark, so you better cut me off now. Well, let me say this as a bridge between the two figures. We mentioned some of their similarities earlier, that they were both prophets of their age. They were both men of remarkable innocence and purity and faith. But I only discovered recently while preparing this episode that Pope Benedict, in fact, quotes no less than four times from G.K. Chesterton and his writings. So let me read just a couple of these examples, and this will be a good bridge between the two of them. In Pope Benedict's book titled In the Beginning, A Catholic Understanding of the Story of Creation and the Fall, Pope Benedict says, G.K. Chesterton was often blessed with the gift of a striking turn of phrase, and he certainly hit upon a decisive aspect of St. Thomas Aquinas when he observed that if the great doctor, Aquinas, were to be given a name in the style of the Carmelite order, for example, you know, Teresa of the Child Jesus or so-and-so of the Mother of God, then Aquinas would have to be called Thomas of the Creator. So Pope Benedict is affirmatively quoting G.K. Chesterton's description of Aquinas. Another instance comes from Pope Benedict's book, Co-workers of the Truth, and he says that the church came to understand Chesterton when he described men and women who, signed with Christ's cross, cheerfully walk through darkness. And I won't read the other ones just because I think that one perfectly describes who Chesterton was. And it's clear that Benedict must have had a good familiarity with Chesterton and his writings to be able to nail that description of Chesterton as one who cheerfully walks through the darkness, signed with Christ's cross. So Chesterton to Benedict, there's a clear connection there, but I'm going to kind of sit back here, Blake, and let you go for the next couple hours on Pope Benedict.
Exactly. No, I'm thinking about that wonderful quote from St. John the Baptist, you know, he must increase, I must decrease. So Chesterton must decrease, Benedict will now increase.
They can both increase. He must increase and he also must increase.
Well, Chesterton increases in more than one way, you know, sort of increases his forward with his stomach sticking out and his wonderful joviality. But all joking aside, there is another connection that Bishop Barron really made me aware of when he had his wonderful series, Pivotal Players, which I suggest to everybody. It really is a great series. I use it with my young adults even for our formation nights. And he mentioned the fact how one genius usually leads way to another. This is how God continues to speak to the world throughout history in his saints. And he noted that Michelangelo, the same year that he died, was the year that Shakespeare was born. And you could see this continuation of artistic genius in the world. Well, it's interesting to note that the year that that Chesterton dies, Benedict had just turned 9 years old and received his first Holy Communion. And so you see this connection between Chesterton and Benedict's life crossing over, even in Benedict's childhood in Bavaria. So Pope Benedict XVI, originally named Joseph Ratzinger, was born in 1927 in Bavaria, an incredibly devout Catholic part of Germany. So that Germany was unfortunately attacked, if you will, or split apart in many ways culturally by the Protestant Reformation. But there were still several strongholds of Catholicism, and Bavaria most certainly is one of them. And Ratzinger grew up in that area of Germany. with a wonderful mother and father, and also with his brother and sister, very, very devout Catholic family. His brother also became a priest. And at a young age, Ratzinger, Joseph Ratzinger, was identified as having a keen intellect. So he was very intellectual even as a boy. He loved school, but also had a deep love of the faith, specifically of the sacred liturgy and the Holy Eucharist. He loved attending Mass, strongly enjoyed being an altar server. He would constantly ask his mother to be present at the different liturgies, especially during Holy Week, which remains even until this day, one of his favorite times of year. And it's interesting that he is now officially the longest living pope in world history. So he just turned 93 this year, and he will go down in the history books for many ways, but that's just one of them. So, like I said, he wanted to be a priest when he was very young. He enters into seminary. His brother also enters into seminary. They're both ordained. But, of course, we know what happens before that time period is the Nazi regime takes place. And unfortunately, Joseph Ratzinger's family is under immediate threat of the Nazis because his father is openly critical of the Nazi regime and most certainly against it. And Ratzinger, as a young boy, even has a short stint within the Hitler Youth, which was required at that time under the Third Reich. And he does escape along with his family, and they flee to a safe part of the country where they wait out the rest of the war. But within this horrific part of German history, Ratzinger starts developing in his teenage heart this deep understanding of human suffering, this deep understanding of the fallout of modernity and postmodernity, specifically the philosophy of Friedrich Nietzsche, which is what gave birth to the rise of Nazism. We know that Adolf Hitler endorsed Friedrich Nietzsche very vehemently because he thought that he himself and his race was the Übermensch, the Superman. And so that kind of thinking is what gave way to the Nazi regime, gave way to all these horrific forms, even nowadays, of dismantling human dignity. And that really is formative for Ratzinger in his boyhood and in his teenage years. So he enters into seminary with his brother. Both he and his brother are ordained. And he spends a small stint in a parish before he's sent on for further studies. So once again, even the bishop recognizes his intellect. And he thrives in school. And while he's there in further studies, there are two thinkers that really speak to his soul, Augustine and Bonaventure. And this becomes the focus of his doctoral dissertation. And you can see that, by the way, throughout the rest of his clerical career, throughout the rest of his vocation, his priesthood. Every single one of his writings are very Augustinian in nature, more so than, let's say, someone like Gregory Lagrange, who was Thomas. You know, you could see in his writings that he's very much influenced by Thomas in a good way. I mean, he's a phenomenal theologian. But Benedict is patristic in his style. You could tell in his writings that he had loved Augustine, and he had also read many of the other church fathers that influenced his theological way of writing. It influences his tone even until this day. And you see it especially typical in his book, Jesus of Nazareth, where he's able to weave in and out of these different ways to theology. Weave in and out of these different themes from poetry to prose, speaking about the height of theology and then relating it immediately to the modern man and woman and what we need to do to grow in holiness. He's recognized so much so for his intellectual life that he is invited to a very important event in world history in 1959. And what is that? The Second Vatican Council. So we know that St. John the 23rd officially convokes the beginnings of the council at that time period. The height of the council takes place in the early 1960s. And Pope Benedict XVI, at that time, Father Joseph Ratzinger, is very much involved, and he's a young man at this point. He's not a Monsignor. He's not some sort of seasoned priest. I mean, he is a relatively newly ordained priest, but he has an essential role at that council, and he's recognized by people across the board, from Henri de Lubac to Yves Congar, Marie-Dominique Chenu. All these heavy hitters of the council see in Ratzinger this potential for great theological genius, and they turn to him and allow him to be part of many of the advisory councils. Benedict had a deep love in his heart for two of the documents in particular, Lumen Gentium, so this document which talks about the essence of the church, and Sacrosanctum Concilium, the document on the sacred liturgy. The liturgy will be the central point of Ratzinger's theology and spirituality for the rest of his life. He says this in that book, The Last Testament, which is a recent writing published by Peter Sewald, who was really the biographer. Each pope sort of has a biographer that focuses on his life. And Peter Sewald is the biographer for Pope Benedict XVI. And when he interviews Pope Benedict, what is the real center of your life? What is it? What if you were able to summarize your theology, what would you say? And Pope Benedict says the sacred liturgy. Everything in his life revolves around this fact that God desires to meet humanity in history and to share that love constantly through the sacramental life of the church. And this becomes the pivotal center of Joseph Ratzinger's life. So I'll fast forward because there's so much in a life of 93 years, but we know that he's eventually called to be the archbishop. So he teaches as a professor, then he's called to be an archbishop in Munich. And then he's called from there to work at the Holy See. He is named a cardinal during that time. He becomes head of the Congregation of the Doctrine of the Faith, which used to be the Holy Office of the Inquisition. So I think that was a cool name, but they changed it. For some reason, they changed it from the Inquisition into the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith. And that's when he acquires international fame insofar as his theological prowess. And then, as we know, he was elected Pope. And I remember the day he was elected Pope. I was in school, and they ended up putting it on all the television screens in the cafeteria, and we all watched him come onto the balcony. Little did I know that he would become, for me, one of my personal role models for holiness, as well as one of my personal inspirations for theology, priesthood, and study. And in his papacy itself, although it was brief, he was also able to accomplish a lot. He followed one of the giants of church history, St. John Paul II, and he was able to continue John Paul II's mission of properly implementing the Second Vatican Council. John Paul II recognized that there was a failure in implementation of the Second Vatican Council, and Benedict really did much to leave us resources to remedy that situation, and that still needs to happen in our own day. We need to reclaim Vatican II. And he also left us a real plethora, rebirth, if you will, of patristic theology. His books, in my opinion, will feed the church's theology probably for the next century or so. He'll be the guiding theologian of those who want to really remain in the orthodoxy and the tradition of the church and to think with the church. And so that's a brief bio of Pope Benedict XVI, incredibly brief. There's so much I could say. I love him to death. And so with that, is there anything that you would like to add, Brandon? Or I know that he's also very close to your heart as well.
Yeah, I've always enjoyed Benedict's writing, but it was only through friendship with you that I came to have a much stronger devotion. I think I only read maybe two or three books by Ratzinger Benedict before we became friends, and now it's, you know, a dozen or a couple dozen, and I've come to love him as you do. Maybe I'll ask you this. We'll get down to favorite books by Benedict, and then where should we start reading Benedict, just like we did for Chesterton. But before we get there, let's talk about what would you identify as the greatest contributions that Ratzinger / Benedict has made to the church? We've hinted at some of them already, but maybe we can identify a few specific ones.
Most certainly. Benedict is at the cusp of what we call the Ressourcement movement. So just if you want a full explanation of this, you go back to our Vatican II episode, where we have a significant amount of time dedicated to the Ressourcement movement. But in brief, the Ressourcement movement was a group of theologians over a several century period, by the way. It wasn't just the 19th and 20th centuries, but really starting with Blessed Cardinal Newman. And
Saint.
Well, now he's Saint. I'm sorry, that's right. I'm so used to saying Blessed. So Saint Cardinal Newman, starting with him and then really going throughout the early 20th century, you have a group of theologians who rediscover the wealth of patristic theology. So patristic theology is that time period of early church history. So the writings of Cyril of Jerusalem, Basil of Caesarea, Gregory the Great, all these wonderful thinkers in the early church. Well, they had sort of been lost to history, the great bulk of them, for many centuries in Catholicism, even up to the Council of Trent. And that's why Trent really doesn't have any patristic references, whereas Vatican II has hundreds of patristic references throughout its four major documents, as well as the other post-conciliar documents.
Let me interject there. When you say they've been lost to history, do you mean people just lost interest in them, or do you mean the actual texts themselves just weren't being published and copied?
The actual texts themselves were not being published and copied. And so after the fall of the Roman Empire, specifically in the church in the West, we know there was a large gap in the intellectual continuation of tradition in the Western church. And that was through no intention of anybody. It was just a fact of history. And so you don't start seeing a renaissance of really Catholic theology in the proper sense until the Middle Ages, especially through the works of Thomas Aquinas. But even Aquinas only really uses two church fathers, Augustine and Dionysius. But besides that, he doesn't really reference anyone else because the resources are not available. So they become available well after the Council of Trent through the discovery of British, French archaeologists who are able to find in different libraries, especially within the desert regions of Egypt, documents from the ancient church or copies thereof. And this leads to a rebirth of theology. So going back to Benedict XVI, you had a lot of thinkers who were at the forefront of this kind of renovation of theology, most notably Henri de Lubac, who is probably the greatest theologian of patristics of the 20th century. But what Benedict represents, and this is what I believe is one of his greatest contributions, is the synthesis of these two centuries worth of renewal in patristic theology in the life of the church. You could see in him what was only roughly being thought out in Newman, what was sort of brusquely being formed within the ideas of de Lubac and von Balthasar. You see in Ratzinger a refinement and a clarity of them. You see that he gives to the church a very concise and a very beautiful synthesis of patristic theology, along with all the beautiful aspects of contemporary theology, of which there are many. And he ties that now to the problems of the modern world, economically, sociologically, geographically, politically. And he does this in an amazing way. So that's one of the major contributions. And the second that I would say, which we really don't appreciate so much right now, but we will in the upcoming decades, is his to the continuation of the Second Vatican Council and its proper implementation in the life of the church. We have yet to really reap all the full fruits of the Second Vatican Council, and Ratzinger recognized that very clearly. He left us some splendid text and resources to reclaim Vatican II and to implement it the way that the Council Fathers and the Holy Spirit intended it to be, and that has yet to be done in many ways. So he was also wonderful in contributing that aspect to the church.
You know, it strikes me when reading Ratzinger Benedict that just as Chesterton wrote on everything in the world in general, Ratzinger Benedict, he didn't venture often to comment on cultural subjects. He kind of stayed within the churchy world. But within that world, he wrote on everything. He wrote on eschatology, Bible, Mary, church, spirituality, holy, you know, every single theological, philosophical, spiritual topic under the sun he wrote on. So he contributed something to everything. I think what sticks out to me, though, is certainly in addition to the ones you just made, I'd wholly agree with those contributions. But also, I'd say the right way to do biblical scholarship and more specifically, the right way to do biblical theology. So he, I think, stands at the fore of this revival in authentic Orthodox biblical scholarship and doing it faithfully in the heart of the church, not sort of sidelining theology and doctrine when doing biblical scholarship, but incorporating it into a synthesis. I think we've talked about before his approach to the historical critical method, which was gaining a lot of traction in the middle to late 20th centuries, 20th century, where the focus was more on the texts themselves, their formation as historical documents, their authorship, you know, questions of redaction or copying and things like that. What sort of fell to the side was the texts as inspired documents, as documents inspired by God himself, as the word of God. So Benedict helped to revive that fuller understanding of how to approach the Bible. And then finally, I think what has really stuck with me whenever I read his writings is he just has this really balanced, careful, thoughtful, generous approach to writing. He strikes me as like the perfect way to do theology. It's not polemical. He almost never, in fact, I don't think I've ever read him take, you know, a snarky political shot, shot at one of his opponents, nor does he ever engage in strawmanning his opponents. Even when he's writing about people with whom he disagrees, it's always generous. It's always intellectually substantial. He lays out their position fairly. And almost like Aquinas, he doesn't just take sort of a binary either or position, like this theologian or that idea is all bad or all good. He's able to kind of engage arguments he disagrees with and find, you know, the good kernel within it and get rid of the husk. So I think his style of theology, his style of biblical scholarship might be his most enduring contribution.
Yes, that's very important as well. I would say along with his contributions of implementing the Second Vatican Council, I agree with you. his approach to biblical theology, which before him, and again, De Lubac and von Balthasar do a wonderful job with the same thing, but before really Ratzinger, it was very popular across Catholic circles and Protestant circles to try to demythologize, quote unquote, the sacred scriptures, which meant to try to take out all divine intervention. So it was this artificial humanization of Jesus at the cost of his divinization of what he really comes to do to save us and the mystical aspects of theology. Well, Ratzinger was able to approach using the tools of modernity, so historical critical method, archaeology, the studies of findings with these different studies of language, but then to integrate that into the larger tradition of Catholicism, because in the end, who knows better about Christ than the church, the living bride of Jesus? It doesn't matter how many practical tools you get. No one really knows the heart of Jesus like his bride does. So Ratzinger was able to synthesize those things together really, really well.
All right, let's move on to the favorite works section. And this will be as challenging for you as it was for me to name my favorite Chesterton works. So maybe give us somewhere between 1 and 50 of your favorite Benedict works.
So for our listeners, Brandon Vaught has read, you know, dozens and dozens of Ratzinger books. I've read every single Ratzinger book, and I'm not exaggerating, that has been published so far, and even a few in a different languages, in Italian. I love Joseph Ratzinger. I love Pope Benedict XVI. He's by far the most influential, along with the Church Fathers, the most influential theologian in my life. So this is very, very hard for me to narrow down. But as I prayed about it, there were two that have been most formative among the many, many. And that is, firstly, the spirit of the liturgy. This is particularly important for me as a priest. For a priest, there is nothing that you do that is more important than the sacred liturgy, period. Brandon, you were studied in engineering or architecture. You know, you had this background in that field. You have other people who have backgrounds in medicine, and they're expected to be experts in medicine. As a priest, I'm expected to be an expert in the sacred liturgy. That is the first and foremost thing that should form my priestly heart, engage all of my priestly life. And everything else is secondary to the sacrifice of the Holy Mass and the other sacraments of the church. That kind of thinking, that kind of proper orientation and focus of the priestly vocation is what was inspired by the spirit of the liturgy, Pope Benedict XVI. And I think this is a book that every single Catholic should read, ASAP. Firstly, because Ratzinger puts the liturgy within a larger framework than most of us have. So to a lot of us, the sacred liturgy is the Mass and how we say the Mass. But Ratzinger does a wonderful job, specifically through the influence of Maximus the Confessor and some of the other great early theologians of the church, of define the divine event of salvation. So the liturgy is not just the specific rubrics that we use for the liturgy, but it is the whole event of Christ actively saving us here and now. The liturgy is something constantly taking place within the heart of the Trinity. And what we call rubrics, or those specific ways in which we celebrate the liturgy, those are just our manners of sharing in that eternal liturgy that's constantly happening between the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit. He also gives, in spirit of the liturgy, what is, in my opinion, one of the best reflections on the book of Exodus ever written. And I really mean that. And I'm talking going back to Origen's commentaries on Exodus, which are superb. This is one of the best commentaries on the book of Exodus, and understanding Exodus as a liturgical book. The fact that the Israelites are not freed for the sake of the Holy Land, but rather they're given the Holy Land for the sake of the liturgy. The whole thing that makes the Holy Land holy is the sacred liturgy. So spirit of the liturgy is wonderful, and it also gives some practical advice on how we could reclaim Vatican II and the proper reverence and due respect for the sacred liturgy nowadays. The second book that has also been very formative for my spiritual life is Jesus of Nazareth. Some call it Volume 2. It's sort of confusing because he published them out of order, but it's the volume on Holy Week. And even more specifically, the chapter on the Garden of Gethsemane, pages 154 to 156. And those pages have shaped my understanding of the sacred Triduum, which are the 3 days, Holy Thursday, Good Friday, Holy Saturday. And they also revitalize a whole mystical understanding of Jesus Christ and his passion, death, and resurrection that really has been dormant for the past 800, 900 years. And so Benedict is able to use the theology of the Church Fathers to bring back to life an understanding of the sacred Triduum, the likes of which the Church has not seen in many, many centuries.
I'm really proud of you for just sticking with one of the Jesus of Nazareth books, because you recently did for your parish. You've been doing these Book of the Week videos like once a week for your parish, and you're like, the Book of the Week or Book of the Month this month is the Jesus of Nazareth series, and you talked about each of the three books, and I was like, that's totally cheating. That's like me saying the Book of the Month is the collected works of G.K. Chesterton, all of them.
It was funny because some of the parishioners and some of the other people that follow me on social media, they all said the same thing. They're like, you just gave us like a year's worth of reading for your first book of the month. I'm like, no, read it this month because I have another one coming up. So I was very disciplined in this podcast. I only stuck to these two, and I'm going to stay with that.
I would share those. I think the spirit of the liturgy is a great starting point, only because, as you say, it's his most important book on his most important subject, the liturgy. And then the Jesus of Nazareth series, that's where I would recommend, if somebody's never read a word of Benedict, start with one of those. It really doesn't matter where you go in. You might time it based on what point of the year you're in. So, you know, if Advent's coming up, read his the volume on leading up to the infant narratives.
The nativity narratives.
The infancy narratives, I think it's called. And then, as Blake said, if you've got Lent coming up, you know, read the one on Holy Week, or if it's ordinary time, read the other one. So I'd recommend any of those. What especially sticks out to me about those books, Blake, is he writes in such a way that there's a seamless blend between theology, Bible, and spirituality. Like, yeah. Usually if you go to most, say, bookstores, like one of our favorite bookstores, Bright Light, those are three different sections in the bookstore. You got theology, you got biblical commentaries or Bible analysis, and then you have spirituality. I remember something Bishop Barron once said, that if you took a time machine back to St. Augustine in the 4th century and you said, you know, give us your books on theology and then give us your books on spirituality, yeah, he like wouldn't understand what to make of that, because that division didn't exist. And unfortunately, yes, it crept in especially during the advent of modernism and the Enlightenment.
Yes.
But Ratzinger Benedict goes back to that patristic harmonization, synthesization of these two things. It's all together. It reads like it's theology infused with spirituality and the gift of the Holy Spirit. It's beautiful to read.
It is. That goes back to the point of the contributions that Benedict has made about the being the real header, if you will, of the Ressourcement movement. But Ressourcement in general, that whole group of theologians, Yves Congar, Henri de Lubac, Hans von Balthasar, these wonderful thinkers, that's their goal. Because what had happened after modernity, specifically after the 16th century, is that theology became compartmentalized. And so now we just have a bunch of specialists. And I would hear this all the time with some of my academic colleagues, how they'll say, well, I'm a Bible scholar. Go to the spiritual theologian in order to talk about that. I don't deal with spirituality. It's like, no, you're a theologian. We're supposed to deal with all things that are of God, all the theologos. So the Ressourcement movement really strives to reclaim that original Christian notion that there are no specialists in theology. But rather in theology, what we need to really focus on is the whole truth of divine revelation, the entire deposit of faith, and what can we do to make that an evangelical mission in the world.
All right. Well, let's see if we could possibly close this in before an hour. It looks like we're at about 57-ish minutes right now. I'd like to leave this closing thought with the very little influence and authority that you and I have with this dinky little podcast. I'd nevertheless like to raise the banner of proposing that both of these great men, Chesterton and Benedict, become known forever as doctors of the church.
Yes.
I think it's far more likely for Benedict, but I think Chesterton also has a strong case. You know, doctors of the church are special men and women throughout history who contributed something significant and lasting to the world of theology or spirituality. And I think Benedict has a clear and obvious case. He's, you know, arguably the greatest theologian ever to be Pope, and he contributed so much to this landscape. But Chesterton too. Chesterton both in his style and his the way that as a layman and as a married man, he lived out the universal call to holiness even before Vatican II called for it. I think he's given the church a unique body of teaching and doctrine that could qualify him for these titles. So what do you think? Dr. Gilbert Chesterton, Doctor of the Church, Joseph Ratzinger, Doctor of the Church, how's that sound?
It sounds splendid, absolutely splendid. And I agree with both of those. And I'll just say on Benedict, when God does take him home, and we don't know when that will be, it seems almost imminent at the time that this podcast is being recorded, but when we'll only really recognize the kind of man that he is, the kind of priest that he is, the kind of pope that he's been when he's gone, and we look back and we recognize the fact that we were alive during the time period of another Gregory the Great. I mean, another Leo the Great. I mean, this man, and even Pope Francis said that recently in a book that was published with the collection of writings of Pope Benedict. He said that Benedict will be remembered with Leo the Great. I mean, that's how significant this man's theological enterprise has been throughout church history. So I do suggest to our listeners, to both of these superb doctors of the church, please expose yourselves to them. Please read them and really make them an integral part of your personal study. I have a whole collection of Chesterton works and a whole collection of Benedict works, and I reference them weekly, honestly. I read either one short essay by Chesterton, or I'll pick up and just read a chapter of one of Ratzinger's books, and it keeps my theological acumen and my spirituality really sharp, to sharpen them against the great iron of these two men's holiness.
Well said. Well, thanks so much for listening to this episode. Pick up a book by Chesterton. Pick up a book by Benedict. I'll link to all the books that we mentioned in this episode in the show notes, so you can find those at burrowshirepodcast.com. Again, thanks for listening. We'll see you next time on the Burrowshire Podcast.